So Vanaraji asked me to talk about Bhante, and my immediate response was very positive and enthusiastic. Actually, she asked me to talk about my relationship with Bhante. And after I'd said yes, I thought, oh, that's quite interesting, isn't it? What is my relationship with Bhante? Now, before I tell you what my relationship with Bhante is, I'd like to tell you who Bhante is, because for some of you, you may not have come across this one. You're sitting in the London Buddhist Centre Shrine Room. If it weren't for Bhante, Urgyen Sangharakshita, you would most definitely not be here. You might be practicing meditation somewhere else, but you would most definitely not be practicing meditation in the Tri Ratna movement, and you would most definitely not be practicing meditation in a context where the Buddha's teaching has been translated into a language which is entirely according with our contemporary life and philosophy and thought. So Bhante Sangharakshita, or again Sangharakshita, is the founder of our movement, and he's also very, very interesting and extraordinary man. So to speak to you about him is for me a tremendous privilege. And I hope by the end of what I've got to say today that you will have some sense of him yourself, and also perhaps a sense of kind of being encouraged to not only practice meditation but find out about the Buddha's teaching and go that bit further in your own pursuit of freedom. So when I called my talk The Challenge of Freedom, I kind of wasn't quite sure why I called it that either. These things sometimes just come to you, you know, and you're not quite sure why it is. But just in the meditation before the tea break, I began to realise why I wanted to call it that. Because, in effect, for me, the Buddha's teaching is a kind of tremendously joyful thing, and it promises me a kind of sense of freedom that nothing else in my life has done, even though I've done a lot of things. But the trouble is, it's not an easy road. But I'm sure you in your lives would agree that the things that come easy are sometimes not the most valuable things. So in the pursuit of freedom, there have been challenges, and there have been setbacks, and there have been sadnesses, but there's also been tremendous amount of joy, a fantastic amount of fun, and tremendous inspiration. So I hope that some of that quality will come through what I have to say to you. And if you're all nodding off and dropping off, then I'll maybe get you to do something, otherwise I'll just carry on talking. So I began to reflect on my relationship with Bhante. Who is Bhante? Bhante is the founder of our movement. And Bhante in India means teacher. So he's our teacher. So Urgyen Sangharakshita is our teacher. And we call him Bhante. It's a kind of very respectful but familiar name to give to someone who you revere as your teacher. But when I was thinking about my relationship with him, I realised that it is quite unique and it's also quite extraordinary. But could I say it's a personal relationship? I've visited him twice in Birmingham for an hour each time. So how can it be a personal relationship? It's certainly not anything like any other personal relationship in my life. And yet, it has the flavour of being intensely and intimately personal. But I've spent 2 hours talking to this person. It also has the flavour of one of my favourite lines in the Ti Ratna Vandana. Some of you will have chanted that. It's where we chant respect or in salutation to the three jewels of Buddhism, which is the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the community of people who practice the Buddha's teaching. So then my favourite line in the T. Ratnavanan is, the nature of a personal invitation. So this is one of the qualities of the Buddha's teaching. It feels like it's a personal invitation to you, and you, and you, and me, and all the rest of you. But personal. It's not just a sort of general invitation. It's specific. So when I just remembered sitting with Bhante in his room in Birmingham, covered walls covered with books, and this gentleman in very sensible slippers, I remembered that I felt as though I could talk about absolutely any aspect of my life. And it was quite extraordinary that there wasn't any sort of sense of having to be terribly sort of holy or sacred or anything. I could have talked about anything, and that I was already understood without me having to put words to my experience. Don't know if you can recall having that experience with someone who's just incredibly wise, actually. And you feel already held, even though you don't know the person. So I realized that when I was going to give this talk, I wanted to explore what that personal invitation might mean. It's been a very inspiring relationship in my life, hugely supportive and yet often uncomfortable and challenging. And I've been coming to this Buddhist center now for 25 years. So in preparation for talking to you, I've been thinking about Bhante, my teacher, as a man. And I've been thinking about him as a visionary and as a friend and teacher, and as a translator. And then, looking at how we practice spiritual receptivity, and I understand you were talking about that last week, those of you who were in the class. How many people were here last week? A handful of people. So, what I mean by spiritual receptivity is that we can prepare ourselves to be open to hear what it is that's being said. Or we cannot. We can be skeptical and questioning and think, well, actually this isn't for me. Or we can just wait and see whether it's for us or not. So there's something that's a kind of thing that we can opt into to be open, be receptive, be ready to hear. And this is a particularly important thing when we're talking about the teachings of the Buddha, because it is back to this idea of it being a personal invitation. It's something that you yourself have to decide to engage with. Otherwise, it's just like a sort of group practice, and that's not what we're doing here. I'm going to talk about all of those things if there's time. But just first of all, I wanted to give you something of a flavour of what I saw when I first saw Bhante. So I recall being very surprised the first time I saw him, because like you, I'd been sitting in the women's class, and I'd been going to the Tuesday class, I'd been going to the Wednesday class at the London Buddhist Centre in 1988. And one day I saw this quite elderly gentleman in a tweed jacket walking very slowly and deliberately up Globe Road. And in his hand he had a nice blue glass bottle, you know those Neil's Yard bottles, of shampoo, which he had purchased at Friends Foods, which used to be in the shop where Lama's Pyjamas is now, if you've been to Lama's Pyjamas. Anyway, so I thought, who's that? And then I noticed that he was walking along with his companion, who I happen to know, and I realised that that was Bhante Sangharakshita. He didn't look at all charismatic, and he was a most unlikely figurehead for an international Buddhist movement. By that stage, it had been established in pretty well all the major continents, and there were classes all over the place. And I quickly began to realize that this movement was radically changing many of the assumptions which underpin our society. It was a radical and challenging movement. And it was extraordinary. So people of my generation, 25 years ago coming here, we observed Bandhi Sangharakshita from the outside, as it were. Not many of us got to know him as the man. Our day-to-day teachers, like Pranidevi teaching you here in this class, our day-to-day teachers had been taught by his first disciples. We weren't taught by him. He'd already pulled back from directly teaching the classes in the centre. And his first disciples, in fact, had almost begun to pull back a little bit. I mean, those are the people who set up our movement in the late 60s and 70s. And some of them had lived lives of extraordinary commitment and in some cases struggle in order to set up the contexts where the Buddha's teaching could be taught. I'm sure you've heard tales of how this building came to become a Buddhist centre. It was a burnt out fire station, and the people who built it... Oh, the stories. I won't go into that now because it doesn't really directly refer to Bandhi Sangharakshita. But he knew that his disciples were so committed to the Buddha's teaching that he could pull back in the mid-70s from directly leading classes and having an active role in the teaching part of the movement. So anyway, I turned up to join the beginner's class and learned to meditate in 1988, 10 years after the start of the London Buddhist Centre. In those days, Bhante lived in a little flat, which is now the office and the Urgyen Sangharakshita study room. You know where that is? Oh, on the other side of the courtyard. So he was here, but he was quite distant. So he was present and distant at the same time. I seem to remember I used to bring him his lunch from the cherry orchard, which is now called the larder, but that was a Buddhist restaurant, on Tuesdays, because I used to volunteer on the LBC reception. And in those days, I just hoped that Bhante would not talk to me. And that I felt a mixture of awe and diffidence, and I couldn't imagine what I'd ever have to say to him. I just thought he was like... But eventually I overcame my self-consciousness enough to write to him a couple of times. And I have a card still with me, which Bhante wrote to me. It's a picture of one of the bodhisattvas called Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 arms. And in this card, Bhante says to me that all I needed to do was to practice the Dharma sincerely, and that would help me to make sense of my life. So the Dharma, Buddha's teaching, yeah? Then I came across this book called Vision and Transformation. Now it's not called Vision and Transformation anymore, it's called The Noble Eightfold Path. And I realized that this book was just published, and there was a book launch, and Bhante came to the class to introduce his book. And I read this book, Vision and Transformation, because I'd been meditating on and off for a couple of years by then. And that book has probably changed my life more than any other book. In fact, I realised I'd probably been a Buddhist for most of my 37 years. And I remember the excitement my friends and I felt when we realised that there's this lovely phrase that we were working out the secret of our blood. Have you heard that before? Working out the secret of our blood. Mm-hmm. That you, what's most meaningful to you in your life, and if you can find a way to get onto that, so you're really thinking, what matters most to me? And in this book, Vision and Transformation, a path for doing exactly that is described in detail, and it's the path that was described by the Buddha 2,500 years ago. Now, what was so exciting for me about it was just how clear Bhante's encouragement was, and sort of confirming for us that things change and they grow if we can provide a positive way to relate to them. So if we create positive conditions, we ourselves will change and grow. And that, for me, that was a real message, because I was a bit of a kind of firebrand and had hugely sort of turbulent emotional life. And sometimes I used to feel a bit of a victim of my own unhappiness and extremes of emotional turmoil. And the first chapter of that book is called Perfect Vision. Some of you I know have studied this in your Mitra study course. So the idea of vision was something I knew, because as Prendit Kandy mentioned, I'm a musician and I used to play music at quite a high level. I haven't done any practice for 10 years, I have to say, so I can't do it anymore, but still. So something about playing music in an orchestra, it's an amazing, lovely thing to do. And occasionally when everything comes together, it's mysterious and it's profound. So I sort of had this sense of something other, something strange, something extraordinary that could erupt into my life from time to time. And it was a very intense experience. So what I used to do with that was just sort of long for it to happen again. But I didn't have any notion of how to access it or how to encourage it or what to do with it anyway when it turned up. And what I found in the book Vision and Transformation was that Bhante was beginning to describe that becoming aware of our own experience in these various ways that he describes is what we probably need to do to live our lives with this sense of meaning and value. So Bhante himself was obviously a visionary man, and he describes having read a book called the Diamond Sutra when he was, I think, 16 or 17 years of age. So he was a man, but at that stage he was a young man. He came from Tooting, from a working class family. He'd had a rather extraordinary childhood because he'd been ill quite a lot and had been consigned to bed for over a year. And he'd read just about everything, the whole of the children's encyclopedia and many, many other books that you wouldn't think suitable for a young person. But anyway, he was very widely read at that stage, and he came across the Diamond Sutra, and he describes what happened to him when he read it. I'll read you what he says. "When I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew I was a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of rarefied sublimity, even the most developed people are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time. I at once joyfully embraced it, and with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. Whenever I read the text, I would be thrown into a kind of ecstasy." I don't know how many 16-year-old boys you know, but doesn't quite fit. I used to be a secondary school teacher, and I didn't know many like that. In fact, I didn't know any like that. Again, we have a feeling of just how extraordinary this man is. So what's the quality of the experience he's describing here? And it is something that we get to know, those of us who are a bit more, been practicing a bit longer. There is a quality of freedom in this, but also it's a sort of deep personal identification with something that is meaningful. And that is, in Buddhism, described as faith. You don't have to sort of believe in something. That's not what Buddhist faith is about. It's something that where your things seem to be in the right place. I mean, I don't want to go into faith, although this is quite a complicated thing, but for me it has the quality of energy, confidence, freedom, potential, knowing my own potential and believing that I can work towards it. Courage, particularly, I'm a bit of a coward myself. But when you sort of get to the point where you think, yeah, this is so important, I don't have any problems, I'm going for this. That sort of courage. It also is a dynamic, direct experience, this quality that Bhante is describing here. So, I actually was very inspired when I heard Bhante talk about this visionary experience as a young man. And I did what my teachers told me, and they said, what you need to do is to go on a solitary retreat. So we sometimes do that. You've heard people going on retreats, many of you have been on retreats. So I went off on a solitary retreat shortly after this book was published in 1991, and I went to a place called Shingle Street, which must be one of the scariest places. Does anybody know it? It's, you know it, Shingle Street? Well, I was staying in a little tiny cottage right on the edge, and there was nothing around it except for shingle. And you sort of walk down a shingle path to get to the cottage in Shingle Street. It didn't have any electricity. There was a gas fridge, which I didn't manage to make operate. I never come across a gas fridge before. But the most terrifying thing about it was that in the early morning, it sounded as though people were stomping up and down on the shingle outside my windows. And I just was absolutely terrified. I thought, oh, there's a man out there. Anyway, one day I plucked up courage and I looked out, and there were these hares jumping up and down on the shingle. There were no humans at all. There were hares. Two hares. Anyway, to come back to the point, sorry. I took with me the Diamond Sutra. I suppose I'd taken it because I'd heard about Bhante's experience with it. And I thought, well, let me see what happens to me. It's extremely difficult to understand. But there's a part of it. I just took a notebook from my shelf last night. And guess what? This is the notebook that I had on my very first solitary retreat. And I'm writing about my experience of reading the Diamond Sutra. I wanted to read you a little bit because I copied it out. Those who aspire to enlightenment should recognize and understand all varieties of things in the same way and cut off the arising of views which are mere aspects. Then it says, now in what manner may he explain them to others? By detachment from appearances, abiding in real truth. So I tell you, thus shall you think of all this fleeting world. A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. So thus shall you think of all this fleeting world. All those things are like the touch of a butterfly's wing, aren't they? Impermanent, mysterious, here and not here, present and distant. I'm not sure quite what I understood from the Diamond Sutra, but I do remember having very strong experiences of meditation, again, with the qualities that I was describing as faith just a minute ago. Now, it's all very well having a vision, but the vision in itself doesn't really last unless you have the stability and support to make something happen to it. In other words, we need transformation. Vision on its own won't do it. So, Bhante's message in this book, Vision and Transformation, was very much to do with how we can work with ourselves to change and transform every aspect of our lives so that we move towards this more and more in tune with this vision that brought us here. I suspect if we had time, and maybe we should do this instead of me doing my talk, I don't know, or maybe we'll do it on another occasion, But if I were to ask you what had brought you here to this Buddhist centre, everybody would probably have something in their experience which was a bit visionary. Can you just in your own sort of minds think about what is it? What's brought you here? What's led you here? Is it just because you think Pranya Devi is nice? What is it? It's some aspiration, and that you have some experience already that's making you think, ah, I want more of this. Sometimes it's like that. And for some of us, it's you have an experience already and you think, oh, I want less of this. Too much suffering. So we tend to kind of fall roughly into two camps, those of us who have a very, very positive experience of joy in life, and we're led to seek it and develop it more. And some of us have an experience of suffering that is so strong that we desperately want to find a path to lead away from suffering. And both of those are very much part of the of the Buddhist path. Anyway, friendship is one of the most important things that supports that path, and I started my journey in the company of friends who shared their visions with me, and we began to explore Bhante's teachings about the Buddha's message, and also Bhante's teachings about friendship and about the Sangha. That's the third of the Buddha jewels. There's a lovely collection of Bhante's letters called Through Buddhist Eyes, and in the introduction to it, one of Bhante's first disciples, Nagabodhi, writes like this. He says about Bhante, he is a man who really wants to share himself with others. Whatever physical, psychological or spiritual distance separates us from him, that is from Bhante, that should not lure us into the mistaken idea that he inhabits an ivory tower of self-sufficiency. Sangharakshita places an exceptionally high value on friendship, not merely as an ideal, but as a lived day-to-day reality. So people who know him well know him as a very, very dear friend. And we, remembering that we didn't really see him directly, Bhante, but we understood the importance of friendship. And we were inspired by Bhante's own care and interest in the people he met. I remember one of the people we lived with in our community, Pranya Devi. She had some difficulties in her life and she wasn't sure whether to get married or not. Well, in those days, there wasn't an awful lot of people getting married within the movement. There's a lot more now, I'm pleased to say. But she went to talk to Bhante about whether she should get married or not. And of course he said, well, he listened to her, and he listened carefully, and he heard what she said about her life and her relationship with her partner to be. And he said, do you remember? He said, of course you should marry him. And so she did. And then they had an amazing boy as well. So it wasn't that Bhante had the sort of principles that he just like, stick to, do this, and do that, do that. He listened and worked out what is the best for this person, or helped them to work out for themselves with that level of care and commitment to each of his friends. Now, I, in preparation for this talk, have been reading one of his earliest books, which is called The Thousand-Petaled Lotus. And in this book, he is describing his life from the age of 19. So when he was a young person, Bhante joined the British Army and went to India. And he writes about what happened to him during that time, right from when he left the army after some years in India and travelled right through India, mainly on foot, with one of his closest friendships, described in this book, with a spiritual traveller called Satyapriya, who's a Bengali Brahmin. And they travelled together, walking the length of India from the very southernmost tip right to the north. So during that time, you've got fantastic stories, funny, quirky, moving stories about the people that he met. And I'm struck by how warm he is and in his memory of these people. He's fascinated by them. And at that time, of course, Buddhism wasn't very known even in India, the home of Buddhism. In the time from then, like, you know, in the 70 years since that time, Buddhism has become much more prevalent in India. But Bhante describes in that book how he had met lots of Hindu people, Hindu spiritual practitioners, and from them he learnt the beginnings of his own kind of organized spiritual life. He learnt to meditate from Hindu spiritual practitioners, and he studied the early Vedic scriptures and parts of Hinduism, which in a way were the antecedents of Buddhism anyway, you know, 3,000 years ago. So it's quite interesting seeing how Bhante's own understanding of the Dharma and what should happen in Buddhism was kind of evolving through his contact with Hindus. But he himself always knew that he was a Buddhist, and he wanted more Buddhists to practice with. There's a lovely bit where he's sitting with a great Hindu teacher whose name is Ram Das. And he describes asking Ram Das for a mantra. "I wanted a Buddhist mantra." And Ram Das was a great believer in the efficacy of the Rama mantra, a Hindu mantra. He'd never been known to initiate anyone into any other mantra. However, I need not have worried. He jumped from his chair and, raising his hand in an initiatory gesture, exclaimed, "Your mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum," which is the mantra of Avalokiteshvara, which was the picture on the card that Bhante sent to me. And Bhante writes, "With this mantra of the great Bodhisattva of compassion, I was well content. It was the starting point of a whole network of symbolic associations that gradually came to occupy a central position in my life." So, now, when people talk about the Triratna order, what they say is that the order, that's all of us wearing cases, you know, been ordained, Swadhi, Devi, nobody else here today, that the order is like the thousand arms of this Bodhisattva of compassion, that we are reaching out. I mean, it's such an amazing image, isn't it? That we're reaching out with as best we can with compassion into the world to try to do something that helps, brings to the world what the world needs. So you've got a picture here now of Bhante, young man, travelling in India. And he was also, very, very soon after that, he was beginning to teach in India. He travelled all the way from the south, as I said, up to the north, to Kalimpong. And in that place he set up a little vihara, a temple for Buddhist teaching. And this is where my life overlaps most directly with Bhante Sangrakshita, my teacher, because I had first decided to learn to meditate after studying Indian classical music in Delhi, and I'd been there for 4 months on a sabbatical from my secondary music teaching job in London. And I'd met people who were musicians and meditators there, and I found that classical Indian music is just soaked in sacred philosophies of all sorts. And I then began to connect up the fact that Bhante himself knew lots and lots about Indian culture. He knows about Indian music, he knows about Indian writing. So in a sense, our lives, you know, I could understand more about what had led him to develop his thinking about Buddhist teaching in the way that he had. Well, but the thing is, I mean, I love being in India myself, and I go there to do this work for the Karuna Trust. But my life is so comfortable compared to what Bhante had to go through in his time in India, particularly when he and his mate Satyapriya just decided that they'd give up wearing Western clothes because it was really inconvenient. They'd get rid of all their papers, just throw away their passports and money and stuff like that. And then they'd just set off with a bag of books on their back to walk from the south of India to the north of India. Can you imagine? And this is, you know, nowhere to stay, no people that you actually knew before you got there. But what he writes about in his books is that, you know, he often stayed in caves or semi-derelict temples or viharas, lived on alms food or a very restricted diet. He describes living on tapioca root for 2 weeks, sometimes boiled in water, sometimes not. But the reason he was doing this was because he wanted to find a way to get ordained as a Buddhist monk. And again, he's this young man who's got this spiritual ambition which is so extraordinary. What courage that takes, what single-mindedness. His sort of profound zeal and commitment astounds me. And he was a very young man, but still so clearly very mature and strong in his aspiration. I find that very moving, perhaps because I know how difficult it is, even though you can go first class on a train in India, you know, and you can stay in a very comfortable flat, thank you very much, and afford to go to a Western-style hotel if you're really stuck and you've had too much. I'm just amazed at how he did that. And now I get to another point of connection with my present life and Bhante's experience. As I said, I work for the Karuna Trust when I'm in India, and these projects were started about 35 years ago for the development and support of ex-untouchable new Buddhists. And they were followers of an extraordinary social leader called Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar. I don't know if any of you have heard of Ambedkar. He was the first law minister and author of the Indian Constitution. And amazingly, he was from an untouchable background himself. And Babasaheb Ambedkar met Bhante in India in 1955. And he asked Bhante to give lectures to these simple people, uneducated people from a very, very poor, oppressed, disadvantaged background, because they were becoming interested in Buddhism. So he was trying to encourage Bhante to talk about the basic truths of the Buddha Dharma and to introduce them to the five precepts which we chant in our classes here. And then in October 1956, Ambedkar formally converted to Buddhism, with about 500,000 people also taking the five precepts at the same time as he did. And afterwards there was a huge wave of mass conversions which still continue even now. So we've got a situation in India with 250 million people from this Dalit background who have suffered from an aspect of Hinduism where your caste dictates who you are and how you're permitted to live your life. And even today, the impact of that caste prejudice makes people's lives really, really difficult. They suffer atrocities and oppression that you and I couldn't possibly manage. Ambedkar publicly declared that he was born a Hindu, but he wouldn't die a Hindu. And that's, he converted to Buddhism because it offered him and his followers the right to freedom from oppression, because if he's not a Hindu, he doesn't have to acknowledge the Hindu caste system, you see. And also Buddhism offered them the dignity to accept that they too could grow and develop to access their potential in the way that I was describing earlier when we were talking about faith a bit. So I feel very privileged to be part of a movement in India that still promotes this path of freedom for people from a Dalit background. And on one of my visits to Bante, we talked about the movement in India. And afterwards I asked him if there was anything in his life he felt that he would like to change. And he said, yes, I'd like to have been able to do more for the ex-untouchable Buddhist peoples in India. But actually Bante had most effectively helped those people. He was in Nagpur 6 weeks after Ambedkar's conversion when the news broke that Ambedkar had died. Suddenly he died. One of our friends was writing about it like this. It was a scene of unmitigated despair and utter dejection. A great crowd had gathered, but no one could control their tears and despondency. Bante began to speak. Bante Sangrajita, our teacher, was there, and he began to speak. He offered much-needed encouragement. He talked mainly about Buddhism, telling his stunned listeners that their duty to Ambedkar was now to try to understand and to practice Buddhism. He said, Dr. Ambedkar is not dead. He lives on and will live on in the hearts of his followers. His work will not come to an end. It will be carried on by each one of you. So what Bante is here saying to those people, poor, poor people who'd travelled to hear Ambedkar, but he died, and there they were, left without their leader. What he's saying to them is, you can be receptive. You yourself can find a way through this path to get to your own potential, to find a way to develop. And through faith and imagination, you can find your own value and meaning in life. Even though everything around you is kind of denigrating your right to that human dignity. So the sons and daughters of those people are the people I work with in India today, and they're running hostels that offer sanctuary to about 900 children a year from Dalit backgrounds, and enabling them to go to school. If they didn't go to live in the hostel, they couldn't get to school because there aren't enough schools and they're very difficult to access. So that's what we do. I mean, it is extraordinary to think it's a sort of involved circular story, but in a way, if it weren't for Bante Sangrakshita, I wouldn't be doing that work in India either. You know, I'd probably still be going to India because I fell in love with Indian classical music, but I honestly don't think that I would have had the opportunity to do the work I do, which is fantastic work and inspires and excites me. So this is just a little tiny talk, and there's an awful lot more I could say, but I just wanted to finish up really with the idea that how in your lives it's very unlikely that many of you will meet Bante Sangrakshita in the flesh, as it were. I mean, he's an elderly man, he's not very well. For the next generation, fewer and fewer of us can meet him. And of course there's more and more of us in the movement worldwide. But he is present for us in this practice we have, which is called the Refuge Tree. Now some of you know all about the Refuge Tree. In the Refuge Tree there's a picture, as it were, in this sort of archetypal image of Bante and his teachers, the people who taught him, the people he met in India on his travels. And they're sitting at the foot of the Buddha. And the Buddha is sitting with on one side the Buddha of the past and on the other side the Buddha of the future. And above there, those three Buddhas, there are lots and lots of people who were very important Buddhist teachers of the past. in the countries where Buddhism has flourished. And when we decide to commit to a Buddhist path more formally and we ask to be ordained, we take up a practice which is called the Going for Refuge and Prostration Practice. And what we do is we visualize that refuge tree. It's the tree of refuge, the tree to which we go for support, inspiration, in our imaginations. And remember, I did say at the beginning how important this receptivity is to these images. It's not that you have to take anything literally. In a way, you're opening your heart to an archetypal image, to a poetic, something that's kind of deeper than words, like images can be, can't they? You know, they say something that you couldn't even probably describe. And it became clear to me that in the process of being ordained into this Sri Ratna movement, what was activated was a kind of lineage of spiritual influence which came to me through my preceptor, whose name is Maitreya, and she was ordained by another woman in our movement called Ratnasuri. And Ratnasuri, who's now in her 90s, had been ordained by Bhante. And Bhante himself had been ordained by a Sri Lankan monk called U Chandramani. This lineage of influence, of spiritual influence, goes way beyond anything that I can explain. But just to finish up with, I'd like to remind myself and you, some of you will know this, of a wonderful story of where one of the Buddha's disciples, whose name was Pingya, and he was an old man, and he was too old and physically frail to go and visit the Buddha anymore, and people were commiserating with him about that. And he said, "No worries. There is no moment for me that is spent away from Gautama the Buddha. From this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing quite like it anywhere in the world. You see, sir," said Pingya, "with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind, as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not, to my mind, a single moment spent away from him." So, for those of us who've never met Bhante, but who will have benefited through his teaching of the Buddha Dharma in books and tapes, on free Buddhist audio, or through the teaching of his disciples and their disciples, can we connect on an imaginal level and allow our hearts to open in spiritual receptivity? That's the question. So you can say, where is your vision? How can you connect to it more deeply? How can you open to it? Can this Dharma, this Buddha's teaching, be the key for you to bring you into more meaningful connection with what is of greatest value to you? And for myself, just to finish with, I just feel a rich flood of gratitude for the life of Bhante Sangharakshita, totally dedicated as he has been to the development and spread of the Dharma in this world, in a language that works for our time and which has brought richness and meaning to my life and to the lives of thousands and thousands of other people across the world. And that's all I have to say for today. I just thought, in the last 2 minutes, this is a poem of Bhante's. He writes poetry, I'm sure he still does, and he says it's a very important way to get to know him. And this poem is about the Buddha's teaching, but it's also for me about Bhante as teacher. And it starts with a line which is in the Tiratnavanda again, Satha Deva Manusanam, the teacher of gods and men. And actually, while I was in India one time, I set it to a tune, so I'll sing it to you. So this is Bhante's poem sung to a tune that's kind of inspired a bit by Indian classical music, but you don't need to worry about that. Satha Deva Manusanam, Satha Deva Manusanam, visions. His dreams were visions. In the night, he saw the lords of love and light, and did to them in song and story reveal the peace beyond the glory. Visions, his dreams were visions. Satha Deva Manusanam, Satha Deva Manusanam. Music, his speech was music. All the day he pointed out the noble way to those who wandering in the dark had quite forgot their ancient spark. Music, his speech was music. Satha Deva Manusanam, Satha